What does Kansas City do over the weekend?
Friday, it's pretty mellow. I may just hang out with some friends. And Saturday, I'm usually going out, whether it's Westport, Power and Light, Waldo. I'm kind of all over the place.
I have a lot of studio classes, so I'm usually just working on my thesis.
Well, either something with the grandkids, sneaking down to the lake with some friends, watching Royals games.
Typical weekend. I start with some pregame drinking and then going out with some friends, discussing particularly right now the political issues.
Chores, cleaning, baking something, and reading.
Watch cartoons with my daughters on Saturday morning. I might work out. Church on Sunday.
Play a lot of video games.
Yard work.
Most of the time I normally go to maybe 18th and Vine and go to a nice happy hour or something along those lines, or maybe have dinner with a nice lady.
Who doesn't love dinner with a nice lady? Without the weekend, dinners like these would not be quite so fun. They'd be rushed. You'd have a lot on your mind. In the words of the labor movement advocates who fought for the weekend, the days off of work give us, and I quote, time for what we will. But is the work week still intact with its 5 days on and 2 days off? Or are you squeezing in work emails between innings at the ball game? I'm Gina Kaufman. Today's Central Standard is an ode to the weekend, past, present, and future. Do you have dedicated downtime, like 2 whole days of it every week? If so, how do you spend it? And if not, why not? 816-235-2888. Let's start with a little history of the weekend. Judy Ansel's going to tell us about it. She's director of UMKC's Worker Education and Labor Studies program. Hi, Judy.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm great.
When did the idea of the weekend first come into existence?
Well, actually, the idea of the weekend was a result of the movement for shorter hours. Because in the beginnings of industrialization in this country in the 19th century, people didn't have weekends. And, of course, farmers didn't have weekends before that either. But, you know, factories had people working 12, 14, 16 hours a day, very often 7 days a week.
What was it about the factory work situation that inspired or made people aware of the need for a weekend that farm work had not quite created? I mean, what's the difference there?
Because in farm work, you set your own schedule, and your schedule is often determined by the weather, the time of year, and so on and so forth. But factories needed disciplined workers, and so they imposed shifts on workers that you had to get up at a certain time in the morning, you had to be at work, and you had to work those long hours.
And the sun going down wouldn't stop that like it would on the farm.
Only if you couldn't light the factory. And so before electricity, in fact, you know, like factories worked during the daylight hours. So hours were a little shorter in the winter than they were in the summer. But it was drudgery. And people had no chance to enjoy life at all. And so starting in the 1860s, actually, the movement for an eight-hour day arose, culminating in 1886 on the first May Day as a worker celebration.
And yesterday was May Day.
Yesterday was May Day. It's International Workers' Day as a result of a massive demonstration of and strike of 300,000 workers on May 1st, 1886 across the country. But the greatest number of strikers, something like 40,000 of them, were in Chicago, and they shut the city down, and they marched, and they demanded an eight-hour day, and their slogan was, 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what you will. They had a whole economic theory behind this, which is that if workers had leisure time, they would spend more money.
And I've heard that Henry Ford got involved in the movement for a weekend.
Well, maybe. Certainly Henry Ford was not the major player right in pushing for a weekend. Henry Ford was kind of a slave driver, to tell you the truth.
But
the move for a weekend was really brought to us by the labor movement. The strikes in 1886 were ultimately repressed because it was a tremendous threat to have native-born and immigrant workers striking together, skilled workers and unskilled workers, all unified around this demand for an eight-hour day. And that was very much a threat to the industrial tycoons of the Gilded Age. And so there was a great deal of repression following the Haymarket incident on May 4th.
Can you remind us what happened there?
Well, what happened there was that there was a demonstration to protest the police shooting of several strikers at a McCormick Reaper factory in Chicago. And at the tail end of the demonstration to protest this, there was a bomb thrown. Nobody ever found out who threw this bomb. And the police opened fire. Seven policemen and an unknown number of protesters were killed. And then they arrested all the leaders of the eight-hour movement. It was a great excuse. They put them on trial. It was, by all accounts, a completely unjust trial. And in the end, four were executed. One died in prison, and three others were ultimately served time, and then their sentences were commuted by the governor of Illinois.
So the eight-hour workday that they were fighting for, and what turned out to be just like a movement with casualties, that was the beginning of the structuring of the work week as we think of it today.
Well, it was the beginning of the movement to force both the government and employers to recognize that there should be a structured work week. Because of the people who were executed unjustly, they became known as the Martyrs of Chicago. And on May 1st, every year since then, around the world, workers have come out and demonstrated, no longer for the eight-hour day, but for whatever the causes of labor are. So May Day is International Workers' Day everywhere in the world except the U.S., Canada, and Australia. Go figure. The movement, however, did resume and culminates in 1939 with the passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, which didn't institute the eight-hour day. It instituted the 40-hour week. And instituted the idea that you have to pay a premium for overtime over 40 hours in a week. You know, in the law, it's time and a half. With the idea that if employers have to pay more, they won't use overtime as much, in which case they'll hire more workers. So in a sense, it was an employment measure to try to create more jobs.
And so the 40-hour work week, would you consider that the beginning of the concept of the weekend?
Yeah, I'd say so. Well, at least enshrined in law. People had that concept for a long time. But as the law, federal law in the United States, of course, there were a lot of exemptions, like management doesn't get it. Lots of workers don't get it because of the way they define how you're exempted. All you have to do is earn over $23,000 currently a year, and your employer can exempt you from overtime. That's something the Obama administration is trying to change today, that rule, because it's way too low. There's lots of people who are designated.
Low as in the salary is too low.
Right.
That threshold.
Right. They're making more money, but they really should be entitled to overtime. But there's also lots of workers who are exempted from the law as well. But yeah, that's when we got official recognition that we have a weekend, so to speak.
When you talk about the slogan that involved, you know, 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what you will, is time for what you will, was that sort of a radical idea at that point? Because from what you've described of the way work looked before that, it doesn't sound like time for what you will was something these workers would have had great familiarity with.
Not those workers, but workers in previous centuries absolutely had time for what you will. Like during the Middle Ages, there's studies that have been done that show that people worked far fewer hours. Now, the caloric intake in those days was lower, and they didn't even have the energy to work that much, to tell you the truth. But the fact was, people took off for holidays, for saints' days, all the time. There were many, many breaks built into the day, the month, the year. The idea of a disciplined work week of an untold number of hours really comes in with industrialization.
Before the labor movements you've described, did people find downtime in some other way, or did they just not get it?
I don't follow your question.
Well, when you're describing people with 16-hour workdays, did people find little ways for to find some escape, some relief? Or was it just there was no such thing and they lived without it?
Well, if you were a poor immigrant worker in the United States in the 1880s, your life, it depends on whether you're a man or a woman, to tell you the truth. Because the women, if they worked outside the home, had no time except for taking care of the children in the household. However, a lot of women didn't work outside of the home, and so they took care of that. Men found time, not much, but the saloons were very, very well populated, I have to say. In fact, a lot of the organizing of labor took place in the bars.
Well, a casual observation is that, you know, the more, the more intensely people work, maybe the more sort of quickly they seem to, the more compressed their free time, the more they try to take a fast track to relaxation.
I think that's a good observation.
Yeah. So we make these clear divisions nowadays between work and play. Like, I mean, it just seems that our lives, our deeply human lives, tend to be very separate from our work. But when you were describing a farm before industrialization, I'm guessing that time with family and time at the office, as it were, these weren't totally separate.
That's right.
The idea of the really discrete separation of work and life, this people talk all the time about a work-life balance today. Is that also a modern invention?
Yes, it is. It definitely is. Because when you had, before you had factory production, you had work going on in the home all the time. It was a handicraft type of production. And people also took breaks much more frequently. Even in the early workshops where people were away from their homes, there were many more breaks. There was much less of this rigid discipline of you're at work, you're on the clock, we're paying you, you know, earn your money. That was something that had to be instilled over decades, and then repeatedly, because we kept having immigrants come into the United States, and some of the draconian rules that we had in our factories were a lot of result of the fact that there was a great deal of turnover among factory workers as new immigrant groups came in, and they had to be disciplined to the factory style of work because it isn't anything natural and it isn't anything innate in human beings. I mean, we're not born knowing that we have to put our nose to the grindstone for 8 hours or 10 hours a day. You know, we love distractions.
In the reading that I've done, I mean, I do understand what you're saying, that this is a labor movement victory, the 40-hour work week. But it does seem like commerce and religion had something to do with it, played some role, at least in sort of maybe establishing that this would happen on these 2 days, by and large, Saturday and Sunday. Like, it's no coincidence that the 2 days that make up the weekend are the Christian Sabbath and the Jewish Sabbath. And another thing that tends to happen on the weekend is running errands, which usually involves buying things.
Well, yes, the religious aspect of it, particularly the Christian Sabbath Sunday, was used as an argument for why people shouldn't have to work on Sunday. But believe me, without the labor movement, it never would have happened. As far as Saturdays, you know, a lot of people worked half days on Saturdays, even after we got the Fair Labor Standards Act. Around the world today, the 6-day work week is really common. You know, my friends in Mexico, I've done a lot of organizing work in Mexico, solidarity work. They work half days on Saturdays to this day. So the idea of respecting either the Jewish Sabbath or any other religion's Sabbath is not something that has had much success in winning over employers' work scheduling.
So what do you think about the work week today? I mean, do you think that the 40-hour work week, the 8-hour work day, and by extension, the weekend, that those things are holding up? I mean, we interpret them as the standard, but is that what you're seeing as actual behavior, actual practice in America?
No, we're losing
today?
It. We're absolutely losing the 40-hour work week or the concept of the 8-hour day. Part of that has to do with the decline of unions, But a lot of it has to do with the fact that there's a lot of workers who no longer fit into the mold of regular workers, and the growth of part-time workers, the growth of people who have multiple jobs. I mean, if you have multiple jobs, you're probably working more than 40 and not getting overtime at all. So in many ways, we're losing it. The 12-hour shifts also is something that's undermining it.
KCUR's Central Standard will be right back. When we return, what's happening to the weekend now? We'll hear from you at 816-235-2888 and the experts. I'm Gina Kaufman. Back in a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. Today's show is all about weekends. Yesterday was not just any Sunday, it was May Day. So labor history is on our minds, and the very existence of the weekend was once a labor victory. We've been hearing about that from UMKC's Judy Ansel. So what about you? Are you enjoying your weekends, or are the days at the end of your week being consumed with something else? 816-235-2888. We want to know if you have leisure time, when you take it, and how you're using it. 816-235-2888. Let's bring a couple of other guests in on this discussion. Gerald Smith is the founder and CEO of PlexPod. Hi, Gerald.
Hi, Gina.
PlexPod is a co-working facility in Lenexa. People who work freelance or contract jobs can go there to come together in a shared space and get stuff done separately. And you're also developing a site in the former Westport Middle School building that's supposed to be the world's largest co-working studio when it's done. How many people in the metro area are currently using PlexPod?
We have about 53 companies at that one location, and that's about 150 people that are office there, let's say. And then you have guests and clients in and out of the building every day. We think that Kansas City needs about 500,000 square feet of co-working space very soon.
Who are all these people who are paying for access to a dedicated workspace, and what kinds of work do they do?
Well, it's pretty obvious that we're very focused on entrepreneurism. So startups, growth stage companies, basically people on the front side of their career or their idea, as I like to say, because it's certainly not an issue of age. We speak in terms of millennial-minded, of course, because it's a next-generation model. But the types
of
people.
When you say it's a model, can you describe the model you're describing?
I had someone come in the other day for a tour, and they, at the end of the tour, he turned to me and he said, basically, this is Uber for office space. And I think what he was referring to was it's part of the shared economy. So, you know, you have your team space or your designated desk, or maybe you're in a flex area, but you share all of the conference rooms, all the resources of the building, including a barbershop, coffee shop, digital maker space, things like that. So
I could use a barbershop at work. Well, so what are the trends, do you think, that account for there being so many people who need to find a place to work? Because, you know, there's something changing about how we work.
Yeah. I often say we're in the business of eliminating loneliness and distractions because the home office or the remote worker, let's say, was really invented along with something called desktop publishing in the early 90s when suddenly paper could be printed anywhere. And so we've, in essence, followed this trend over almost three decades. And the interesting data is the Labor Department's data that by 2020, almost half the workforce will be freelancers, independent contractors, self-employed. That's a huge number. So
those are people whose needs you address in the sense that they need a place to work.
They
can work anywhere. But what's interesting to me about this, too, is that it's not just that they can work anywhere. It's that they can work anytime. And it seems that sometimes that means working all the time.
Yeah.
I'm really curious about what you observe in people's work week habits, being that these are people working within their own self-set models, kind of.
Sure. And I think any entrepreneur, especially when you're by yourself or there's just a couple of you, the idea of hours limiting anything is just unheard of. People work all the time. We typically hear people talking in terms of access to the customer. It's not about them as employers, but you know, the internet eliminated time zones. So we have people working in the middle of the night. We have people, you know, working all hours. So it really is just a response to what business you're in mostly.
What was your clue that this was a big enough market that you could start up a business just, you know, providing them with filling this need for this particular demographic, people who need a place and sort of, you know, who need to put their work in a place that's separate from their home?
Well, interestingly enough, as you talk to the people around PlexPod, you'll often hear they still have a home office. But they're seeking corporate culture, in essence, the equivalent of that by being around other humans. But on your question regarding this market, it doesn't take too much to look around Kansas City. I mean, look at the Chamber's Big Five initiative, the first initiative to be the most entrepreneurial city in America. What we're building in Midtown at PlexPod Westport Commons really is only possible because it is Kansas City. We think there's a tremendous fit because the attitude here is one of what we like to think of creator. You see a lot of people creating things. So
it's, yeah, the idea that people are creating both their own schedules and their own workspaces. I mean, when you say they're seeking out corporate culture, is the 40 hour work week part of that or no?
Well, it's the equivalent of corporate culture. I believe that within the next two decades, we'll start to see corporations start to outsource culture, in essence, to gain a few more points on the bottom line. You know, here's your mobile devices. We're glad you're here and working for us. Now go find a place to work. So that won't be that unusual over the next decade or two, I believe. So,
well, Gerald Smith of PlexPod, hang on for a second. Sure. We've got a call that I want to take from Christopher in Blue Springs. Christopher, thanks for joining the show.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone.
Hi.
It's funny that you spoke about, in particular, a lot about almost like work-life balance. I actually do three positions. I'm actually starting up my own company. I actually am an Uber driver. And I also work a daytime job, which I'm en route to go to now. But the biggest thing is that you're absolutely right. I mean, we have outsourced a lot of things. By being an Uber driver, we've outsourced basically taxi services where people can actually get someplace, and in most cases, a lot cheaper than they have before. But I've used that philosophy that I learned from both of my parents, who are both union people. They were in the teachers union here in Kansas City, and so they were a part of that for 30 plus years. And I learned that hard work ethic. And your caller that actually has the FlexPod down in Westport, he's absolutely correct. A lot of the time period, a lot of people want to create things here in Kansas City, but don't know how. But the entrepreneur spirit is definitely alive. And take that from a person that's 50 years old, I know it.
Well, Christopher, I have a question for you. I mean, you talk about driving Uber in between the business that you're trying to start for yourself and what might be, you might call it a more traditional day job, although with the numbers Gerald is listing, I'm not sure that we can say there's anything so unconventional about working an unconventional job. But when you talk about driving for Uber in between there, is that filling up all of your free time, what would have been free time, or is do you still have time for what you will?
I still have time for what I will, because what I can do is I can adjust on the fly if I need to have personal time. That's one of the benefits of not only building a business, but also having flexibility around it. The one thing that I think that people are, especially millennials, in my opinion, are disenfranchised about with corporate America is that they don't have the flexibility to make a decision and be, quote, totally free. With entrepreneurship, things like Uber, building your own company, you have the flexibility to say, you know what, if I want to take a sabbatical, I will. If I want to go do something, I can, because I have that flexibility and I earned it. Does that make sense?
So it's not that there's a weekend where coming up at the end of 5 days, you have these 2 days where you can do what you want. It's that when you need the time to do what you want, you carve it out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's one of the beauties of building what a lot of companies are, especially through the internet and what have you, is that we can actually make our own decisions on what we want to do.
Well, thanks, Christopher. Thanks for that input. I'm going to get some response from Judy Ansel, who is our labor studies person in the room today. Judy, what do you think of what Christopher is suggesting here?
Well, you know, I think that's for most workers who are finding themselves in this new gig economy or whatever, you know, it's being referred to as, it isn't, they don't have those kinds of choices. And
why not?
Well, first off, Jerome talked about, you know, within a few years, 50% of workers are going to be what's called contingent. The fact is that most of that, or a great deal of those people, are not entrepreneurs. They're people who are contract employees who probably should be regular employees because that's a huge area of labor law that's violated. They should be getting a salary, and they're not, and benefits.
There's a lot of current debate about that right now. And in fact, right. Uber, which just came up, just won a lot, you know, survived a lawsuit basically. And
yeah, there's been mixed decisions about Uber, and that the jury's really out on them. But also, a tremendous number of those workers are involuntarily part-time, and they're part-time because many employers now define the work week as 30 hours or 32 in order to avoid paying benefits. And so people are multiple part-time workers. They don't have choices. In fact, their ability to schedule their time, their free time, is really, really shrunken because many times they're on call. And many times they have to juggle conflicting schedules of their part-time employers. And so they find themselves working all the time. And so while, you know, what Gerald is doing is, I think, probably providing a real service for those people who are entrepreneurial, I think that that's just a small segment of what's going on with work.
Gerald, to your knowledge, do a lot of the people who use co-working facilities for some project or some business of their own design, do they often have other jobs that they are also juggling with that?
Oh, absolutely. And Christopher, in his call, you know, the thing that I heard that was the most important was that he's doing three things. He's moving himself forward. Whether all three of those are entrepreneurial, you know, is really up to him and his priorities. But ultimately,
or perhaps his needs.
His needs, absolutely. And it sounds like that's what he's responding to. But I congratulate him, number one, for having that entrepreneurial spirit. But yes, we see people regularly that are starting their thing on the side. They're currently employed. I counsel people all the time about, you know, when do you step out and start your thing? And most typically move too soon, you know. And that's
as driven
in
quit
by,
their day job too
yeah,
fast.
Yeah, and that's driven by excitement. But ultimately, there is a life cycle for the entrepreneur. It's interesting because as Judy's talking, I'm thinking she would be awesome for a lunch and learn at a Plexpod because these companies that are building and growing, they become bigger companies and they start needing to pay attention to labor laws and things like that. And you know they need to get out in front of these things so they can determine what type of company they're going to be. It's all essential to their success.
Well, let's hear quickly from Joshua Montgomery. He's with us from a Lawrence-based startup called Mycroft. He's essentially making a voice-operated house. And last time he was on our show, he was quite candid about the implications of technologies like his for the workforce, because let's face it, a lot of new innovations out there do jobs that either used to employ humans or still employ humans. And as we create more technology that both frees up our time and maybe does our jobs, what's going to happen to the work week? So Joshua, I want you to take a stab at that big, huge question right out of the gate. Apologies.
Sure. Sure. So I'm with Mycroft AI, and what we're building is a natural language platform that can be installed anywhere. And what that means is that us and other companies, big companies like Apple and Microsoft and others, are building these technologies that allow people to interact with computers very, very naturally. And they're also building technologies that allow computers to interact with the real world and replace a lot of jobs. Uber is a great example. Uber has pre-ordered tens of thousands or possibly hundreds of thousands of self-driving vehicles with the goal of replacing all of the Uber drivers with technology. And so as computer systems and as artificial intelligence begins to take a greater role in the working world, there's going to be huge opportunities to reduce the number of hours that people work and reduce the amount of drudgery in the workforce. But at the same time, there's the potential to even further amplify the division of wealth within our society. And I believe very strongly we're at a critical juncture in our social development where we're going to make the decision whether all of these great new technologies that automate the drudgery of life are going to make everyone's life better, or whether those technologies are going to lead us down a path where people are unemployable without a significant level of professional skills.
So is it like maybe either fewer people will work more or everybody will work less?
I believe that those are really kind of the two directions that we have a choice about going. A great example would be the truck driving industry, where we're beginning to see automated semi-trucks being experimented with. They did a great experiment in Europe a week ago where they drove thousands of miles with these automated trucks. And so there's the potential for gangs of trucks. So you line 10 of them up in a row, and they're all driven by computers except for the lead truck where there's a driver. To replace 10 drivers that are doing that work today. And those trucks can produce an enormous amount of wealth for shipping companies. And so the question is can we take the wealth and can we take the automation and distribute it in a way that it frees up the other people that would have been driving trucks to pursue, like Gerald was talking about, to pursue entrepreneurship, to pursue art, to pursue literature, to pursue their passion, rather than replacing the jobs and putting those folks out of work. And
yeah, it's interesting because in the context of a push for better compensated overtime work for more people, for example, it is interesting that as we have these developments that you are describing as having the potential to free people up from work, overtime issues represent the exact opposite.
Absolutely. And you know, Judy was talking about the proliferation of part-time work and where folks have to have, you know, three or four part-time jobs. Part of that is being driven by technology. Over the last 20 years, we've seen profound gains in the amount of productivity per worker hour in our economy. But we haven't seen the same types of gains in the income of folks who are out there actually doing the work. And the question is how are we dividing the spoils of automation? How are we distributing the wealth that this is creating? And I would contend that we're doing an enormously poor job of that. And I know that there's a lot of people in Silicon Valley who are the beneficiaries of this who agree with my position, who are saying the exact same things, that the division of wealth that's resulting from this is getting to the point where it may be dangerous.
Joshua, I just have one. I mean, that is kind of what I was wondering. Are you unusual in being such a proponent of technology and at the same time such an advocate for, I don't know, for somehow adjusting the world to take into account the jobs that are being lost? Because usually you hear people talking about job loss related to technology as sort of an anti-technology position.
I don't believe so at all. I think that those of us who are involved in creating technology, we want to create a utopian world where all of the drudgery of the day-to-day is taken care of by machines and by automation, and where people are free to pursue their passion and people are free to pursue things like art. I believe that most of us, that's what inspires us to go and create new technologies, not with the idea that we're going to destroy jobs. And there are places in the world that are giving this very careful consideration. You know, in Europe, there's countries that are talking about something called universal basic income, which would free the in my example, the nine truck drivers that found themselves without work, it would free them up to pursue their passion And to go do what Gerald was talking about is to pursue entrepreneurship from a position of strength where they know that if their idea, their startup, their technology, their passion fails, that they won't be left destitute in the street.
And as I said last time you shared this position, just observing, that does not sound like capitalism. Mm.
I think that we live in a capitalist society. I think we can choose how deep into capitalism we go and how far we go into socialism. There has to be a balance in our society. We cannot live in a society where all of the capital accrues to just a few people.
Everyone in the room is dying to respond to what Joshua has been saying. So Judy Ansel, first, you study labor. Do Joshua's theories jive with your research?
Well, they jive with my vision for people being able to be creative and pursue their creative instincts without the drudgery of a 9-to-5 or whatever. But they don't jive at all with my understanding of U.S. history, of the capitalist system, and of how we make decisions about technology. If we look at our history, what we see is that when we make decisions about new technology, working people lose. And consistently over time, automation has taken millions and millions of jobs
and not
given the workers who were displaced any choices at all, except working at poorer paying jobs that are often more eating away of their free time.
Let's hear what Gerald was wanting to say here.
Well, I think the missing ingredient, or the important ingredient, as I see, really is entrepreneurism. You've got to create those jobs, and you've got to support and create the platforms by which entrepreneurs can thrive on, because all of this is an evolution. We've seen it over centuries, and I think we will continue to do that. And that's the importance of entrepreneurism, so that it will continue to evolve, and you will have basically new things created that don't exist today. People will be doing things 20 years from now that they aren't doing today.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and Central Standard's got to take one more break. You still have a few minutes to weigh in on this discussion. What's happening to your work week, and by extension, your weekend? Do you have leisure time? 816-235-2888. We'll be right back. Back. And no, we do not have a case of the Mondays, because we just had an awesome weekend. But what about you? Do you have a weekend, and will you in the future? I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's the topic of today's Central Standard on KCUR. Our guests are labor expert Judy Ansel, Gerald Smith, who runs a co-working facility called PlexPod for what used to be called non-traditional workers, and Lawrence-based entrepreneur Joshua Montgomery. As a tech guy who thinks a lot about the implications of what he does, he has questions and ideas about the future of work and leisure, considering how technology is making certain jobs obsolete. We have lots of callers, but we also left on a very contentious note about what technology replacing jobs should mean, but what it often does mean. We'll get back to that, but I want to hear from Dan. Dan is on the line from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Dan.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How about you?
Great. Thanks. Great topic today. I called in because we're talking about the weekend. Every day is the weekend for me and my wife, and I'll explain why that is. We started about 3 years ago when we were living in Dublin, Ireland, letting out one of our rooms on Airbnb on a nightly basis. At first, one apartment that we were renting. At first, I was really not really into the idea, but when I saw that one room paid our rent and utilities for the month, that set a light bulb off and set in motion to where we now have four apartments that we rent in Dublin, Ireland, that each room is an independent listing on Airbnb. It's not an entire apartment listing. And after everything's said and done, after paying for the labor costs for the two gentlemen who work for us, who have a very much a non-traditional workday as well, we make about $200,000 a year from it. So we're both able to essentially for lack of a better word, retire. And, you know, we work on the Airbnb business about half an hour every day, and the rest of the time we spend with our two young kids.
Wow. So you are telling me that you're living the dream.
We are living the dream, yeah. We absolutely love it, and it's completely changed our outlook on life. It's had us start a conversation about what we do with our savings and how we invest that maybe in other business ventures. We provide three jobs for three gentlemen from South America who not only get a free place to live and don't pay any utilities, but also make about 1,000 euros, so around $1,100 per month.
So your work week
half day.
Yeah, your work week is 30 minutes, 7 days a week.
Yeah.
Okay, that sounds impossible to me, but I'm hearing you describe an arrangement where it isn't impossible. I mean, in the model of labor that we're talking about, sort of large scale, under a model like this, the thing that I wonder about is the future of people who are traveling and staying at the Airbnb.
Well, somebody's going to lose on this one, I'm afraid.
But who? It sounds quite idyllic.
Well, it does. And I personally don't know if $1,000 a month is a good €1,000 a month is a good salary. But it's taking advantage of what's called labor arbitrage, which is, you know, like the difference in standards between what a living wage is in one place and another. But it's also undercutting the hotel industry, where you have a regulated industry, regulated for many reasons why, which is probably in England paying union wages to hotel employees who have protections and have weekends or have, you know, adequate time off. And what Airbnb is doing in general is that it's avoiding years of regulation in the hotel industry and the building up of, in at least some places, decent jobs for hotel workers because of arrangements like this. And so, and it's the same thing with Uber and the taxi industry, is that these are these kinds of arrangements, while they sound great, are often undercutting not only, you know, businesses that have been building up for years, but also decent jobs and unionized jobs.
It seems like another question I would have would be that this sounds like it's working out great for Dan and probably, from what he describes, for the people working for him. Dan also already had a home that he could rent out, and an Uber driver presumably already has a car. So that's access to having already built up some kind of capital.
So I've got a good friend of mine, David Klaus, that started VRBO.com in his basement. And he would argue that what they've created allows a broader range of price points. So more people are traveling. They might not be staying necessarily in that $400 a night hotel on the beach, but they might be a block off the beach. You know, I've seen a lot of his data supporting that. So, I mean, it is all an economy of scale. But ultimately, I think I'm excited that there's opportunity created for entrepreneurs to fill the gaps, to see the holes.
So opportunity for entrepreneurs is sort of like your end game.
Yes.
Joshua, as you listen to this, how do you think that this discussion that you're hearing fits into what you have just described, which is, in your view, a need for someone to step in and make sure that as access to to jobs is possibly affected by technology, that there is some force that steps in and makes sure that people are cared for?
Sure. So this is a good example of rent-seeking behavior. Like you have an asset. There's only a limited number of that asset, and you go out and lease it out to make money. And that's a good position to be in if you were privileged, like you were speaking of, and you had the apartment or you had the car or you came from an
privileged or else had some other job before this.
Yes. And you were given the opportunity to go and earn that. The issue that we have as a society, and I think I highlighted this really well at a company meeting last week, is that you know, the people who are developing these technologies, and in Google's case, you know, they're busy arguing over who has the bigger suite in their private 767, while flying over countries where people don't have enough to eat. And so there are some big concerns about how we distribute that wealth and how we distribute the benefits of the of these new technologies, and you know, we need to work as a society to make sure that's fair.
Gerald, is that something that affects your thinking about opportunities for entrepreneurs, or still entrepreneurs having opportunity is the end game?
Oh, and don't confuse opportunity with the American traditional view of success, you know, build it bigger, greater, stronger. Opportunity, you know, 3 out of 10 millennials are wanting to work for a do-good organization. So I concur with Joshua. Entrepreneurism is as much about fixing many of the world's problems as it is just creating, you know, new income.
So. Everybody's dying to talk, but we also have calls. So quickly, Joshua, respond, and then we're going to get back to our
calls. There's a great example of that. One of the most successful entrepreneurs in our generation, Bill Gates, gave up the pursuit of wealth in order to use his entrepreneurial skills to give that wealth away in the most beneficial way that he possibly could. And that is an example of social entrepreneurship, which is something that we as a society should absolutely be encouraging and funding.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk to Susan, who I don't know where you're calling from, Susan, but welcome.
Hi, Kansas City.
That's a good place to call from.
It is. I am calling because of the comments related to Airbnb. And while I can see that it's a lucrative opportunity for people who have property, one of the things that I've learned is that people converting apartments and rooms into Airbnb has a tendency to displace people, especially at lower and middle incomes, from having permanent long-term housing. Mm-hmm. My son lives in New Orleans, and that's one of the things they're seeing there.
So there aren't places to rent.
There aren't places to rent because they've been converted, since it's a high tourism area and they can make a lot of money renting short-term Airbnb. And that was my comment.
Okay, thanks, Susan. I want to get to another caller just to make sure we have time to hear from him. We've got Christopher in Blue Springs with us now. Hi, Christopher.
Hi, how's everybody doing today?
Good.
Good.
Good, good. I wanted to, I wanted to comment back on the situation that I spoke earlier. Here's I think one thing that is missing is that what this type of entrepreneurship is forcing is not only more education, but also it's forcing people to think outside the box. I think the problem that is going on right now with entrepreneurship is not the concept, especially millennials, and you were right, whoever the pundit that said this, you're right. Social entrepreneurship is coming. It is a movement that's going on. Like, for example, with the company that I have that I'm building, Corby Telecom, we sell not only prepaid phones, but also the service.
Christopher, I'm gonna jump in because I feel like we were maybe about to get off track and we've got just a minute left. I want to give our guests a chance to respond to this because as Kevin tweets, I think one of the counterpoints to this argument could be that this is from Kevin, who tweets us, majority of our populace is not equipped to become entrepreneurs. The majority is getting left behind economically.
Right. And something like 80% of small businesses fail. So, you know, like, this is not a solution for our society. You know, we heard it mentioned that the solution is entrepreneurialism. I think the solution is that workers need to expect more and demand more, and we need to get organized. I mean, the movement of low-wage workers demanding, you know, higher raises. We haven't had a raise. Wage workers in this country haven't had a raise since the 1970s. We need to be making more. And the only way to do that is to have a labor movement which can force our government to enact the laws like minimum wage, but also force employers to deliver instead of taking so much for themselves.
Judy thinks we need a movement. Guys, do we need a weekend too, or do we not need that?
We need a weekend.
Weekends are fantastic, and hopefully technology will enable us all to spend more time not working and less time doing the drudgery of the day-to-day.
Hear, hear.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for today's show. I'm thankful for my weekend and will remain thankful for as long as I've got it. Judy Ansel, director of UMKC's Worker Education and Labor Studies program, thanks for being here. Judy is also the host of a show on labor issues for KKFI. Gerald Smith of the co-working space PlexPod, thank you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And Joshua Montgomery, CEO of Mycroft, it's been interesting talking with you. I appreciate your coming in from Lawrence.
Thank you very much.
You can listen back to this broadcast with all your leisure time or when you're doing dishes, whatever, at kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have it ready for you later today. That's also where you can subscribe to our podcast, which I highly recommend, kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, with Mother's Day approaching, we meet the matriarchs of the Mannheim Park neighborhood just off of Troost. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.